This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The first quarter of the school year is over for K through 12 public school students, and families across the state have spent the past 10 weeks navigating their district's COVID restrictions. Whether remote learning has continued or schools have reopened, children and parents have faced unique challenges this year, and those challenges are far from over. I'm here with Julie Pittman and Maggie Murphy. They have each had a different experience with the first 9 weeks of school. Julie is the mother of twin daughters who've opted to remain under Plan C, or fully remote learning, in Rutherford County. Welcome, Julie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Good to have you. Maggie is a teacher at Piney Creek School in Allegheny County who started out the year back in the classroom under Plan B. Maggie is also 2020 North Carolina Regional Teacher of the Year. Maggie, welcome to you.
Hi, thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
What a pleasure. Julie, let me start with you. Rutherford County is one of those school districts that offered Plan B at the start of the year. You can go into the building. Why did your family opt to remain under Plan C?
Sure. Well, we gave my twin 11-year-old daughters the option of deciding if they wanted to go fully remote or go back to school when the district decided to do so, which was going to be sometime after Labor Day. And they decided, because of the health concerns that we had for some family members who are high risk, that we spend a lot of time with, and the fact that my girls are really active in dance and would be back in the dance studio face-to-face, that they would go fully remote for the first semester. I can tell you that they are ready to go back into the classroom. So as soon as we're able to possibly make that happen, either 2 days a week or full-time, whenever that happens for middle school and high school in Rutherford County, we'll be looking at that option for sure.
Well, let's unpack that ready. What has school been like for them, and I guess for you? But let's start with them. What's it been like this year?
Well, for them, it's been completely different than it was in the spring. They've had a great experience. They're in sixth grade, so it was going to be a really big transition for them to go to a new school. They were a little nervous about that, but we're a one-to-one district, so all of our kids are used to iPads and MacBooks, so for them to be able to have them at home was a little bit different, even though they were used to using them at school. We didn't have to really leap over that struggle of trying to learn how to use the devices, but having to be able to do all of their work in a place that has broadband connectivity issues has definitely been a struggle, where we spent many hours in the back seat of my car parked outside of the schoolhouse back in the spring. We found some places in town that have reliable internet that we're welcome to come and work at every single day when we need to. They're missing their friends. I think they're missing that complete interaction with their teachers, even though their teachers have just done incredible things to build relationships with them. I think they're missing that face-to-face interaction, even though what they remember that used to look like is definitely not what it looks like now. I think that they're ready to have a little bit more engagement.
And has it been difficult for them to stay on task online?
Not my children, although they may or may not be the exception to the rule. I know that there are a lot of kids who have a hard time staying online and staying focused. My particular children are motivated to try to get as much work as they can done in the morning so that they can have their afternoons and evenings free. We've had to do my husband and I are both, my husband is a former teacher. I have been in education for well over 20 years. And as a working parent and a mom and a teacher, we've had to do a lot of extra help for them to make sure that they are bridging the gap in we're bridging the gap for them and the things that they may or may not be able to get that's just virtual and virtually impossible to do it over virtual.
Maggie, in Allegheny County, your school reopened in August. Tell us a bit about Piney Creek and how it implemented Plan C and how often you actually see your students. How many do you teach at one time?
Yes, sir. We started back with option, just as Julie said. So we gave the option to be completely virtual, and we had several students and families that felt like that was better. And so we were able to switch some teachers to just virtual teaching, and then also have enough teachers still in classrooms and have our class sizes to where we could social distance and keep everyone safe. So for me in fourth grade, I have 7 kids 1 week and 8 kids the next week. And we do an A week, B week schedule, but it's 4 days a week, with Friday being a remote day and a teacher planning day. We can have office hours, which allows us to communicate with parents, plan for the weeks ahead, those type of things, and have some professional development time as well. So that has been one huge success out of all of the, like you said, challenges of coming back during COVID.
Well, and go ahead, because I know that you've actually noticed some other benefits too to those modifications that the school made. Tell us about those.
Yes, sir. So the class size, having 7 and 8 kids at a time, has really benefited the kids. So even though I see them, I don't get to see them both weeks, the week that they're here is, it just has been amazing that I can individualize instruction, that I can really target their needs. Even things like grading and kind of getting feedback more regularly has been a really great kind of change from having 20 to 25 students at once. So there are some beautiful silver linings, even though there are challenges among them, for sure.
Julie, you talked about spotty internet connection and Wi-Fi connections as well, and sort of having to kind of find a hotspot in the car. Has that been challenging? I mean, I wonder if there's any stigma attached to that, or if it's been difficult, if the girls don't particularly like that. Well, how does that work for you?
Yeah, they absolutely did not like when we had to do work in the car, and it definitely was something that they felt self-conscious about, both for their teachers and for their classmates to see them there. So being able to find a different place in town that looks a little bit more inviting and comforting than the back seat of the car. And honestly, we're certainly capable of affording internet. We just don't have access to it where we live in rural Western North Carolina. And that is not uncommon for many, many students across the state. And those same students who are having that kind of internet issue and internet inequity, those are the same students who are having inequity in accessing school meals and other wraparound services that our schools are able to offer to our students. So I think as soon as we can try to figure out how to overcome some of those obstacles for all of our students in North Carolina, the better we're going to be as a state, and the more we're going to be able to really get these kids back on track for graduating with success.
Yeah, and that's a real public policy question that could have been addressed at the state legislative level, and some of the options were put off limits by law by the legislature, which is too bad, because that, as you say, you can afford it, but we can't get the internet service in there. It's a public policy question. And let me ask you another question, Julie. What steps has the school taken to ensure that remote learning looks different in the fall? Because they've had some time to, you know, take in their experience from the spring. What kind of changes did they make when school started in September, August?
Yeah, well, the state has done an incredible job for offering resources to support teachers and parents in trying to make learning, remote learning, or part-time, face-to-face, part-time remote learning look different than it did in the spring. You know, in the spring, we had to turn around as a state and as districts basically overnight and try to pivot as fast as we could to just make sure that we were engaging all students. Now, months later, my district, Rutherford County Schools, is not unlike many schools or all the school districts across the state in that they have really invested in helping teachers plan for how to teach remotely, to teach virtually, or to teach part-time in their classes, to make sure that that parents have hotspots and devices. Both districts in the state have invested in making sure that there's more access for technology, and also offer wraparound services, not just for students, but also for their parents, because parents I think a lot of our parents are exhausted in trying to hold up jobs, but also support their students who are now, their own children who are now with them more now than they ever were. So there's a real relationship that that a lot of districts have tried to build with families that has just been a struggle in the past. So again, a silver lining, but it's an uphill climb still for it.
Maggie, I know that your school has had its first positive reported COVID case. How are parents and students responding to that news?
Yes, sir. So this weekend was our first positive case in my particular school. We have four schools in our district, and each of those have had positive cases so far. So we were kind of knocking on wood, hoping we were in this like protective bubble out here at my school. But after hearing of our first positive case, of course, there was a little bit of anxiety. Some parents that were, you know, I had a couple contact me and just say, was it our class? Is everything okay? They just need that reassurance. But also, like Julie said, the relationships we've been able to build with parents and the community, and I think that we have, I think they know that we are keeping their kids as safe as possible, and we are really working hard to keep everything clean and keep social distance and make sure that students have their mask on. So I think it's, I think the anxiety there is definitely warranted, but also, you know, we're doing everything in our power to make sure that our kids and our staff too is as safe as we can be.
Well, we talked about the number of challenges that that families are having to negotiate right now, and we heard from one parent who's had difficulty juggling both work and home and assisting with homeschooling. Here's Stephanie Baker in Durham.
I teach at Elon University, and so I've had to get my parents to help out with childcare for the days that I have to go to campus. But then there are days where I'm teaching my students and she's also learning in her classroom. And so I can't get up to help her problem solve one day. You know, I thought everything went well and I was like, how did things go? You know, Ariana, and she was like, oh, well, I missed my math class, but I didn't interrupt you. So it was like, oh, you know, we have to learn, like, what's important, what's not important. Then I had to, like, send a note to her teacher and apologize because she didn't get into the right math class for that day. So it really has just been this ebb and flow process. And I wouldn't say anything is consistent. It has not been a straight path forward. It is full of good days, good hours, good minutes, and then bad, challenging days, hours, and minutes. It really is kind of unpredictable.
Stephanie Baker, a work-at-home mother in Durham. I'm here with Julie Pittman, a public school parent at North Carolina Education Outreach Manager for Hungry Kids North Carolina, as well as Maggie Murphy, a teacher at Piney Creek School in Allegheny and Allegheny County. Julie, let's talk a little bit about how you're, you know, sort of managing all this, juggling the kinds of work that you have to do as well as be a teacher. How's that working out for you?
So it's a struggle, but it's definitely something that I'm very thankful for the teachers at my kids' school. They're so forgiving and so understanding and so planned for the content that they've got to deliver, but also just the hurdles that they're having to overcome. They've been equipped to really roll with the punches, and that's been really helpful, not only for me, but also the other families that I'm engaged with in my own district. The work that I'm doing with No Kid Hungry in North Carolina has looked a little bit different during this season than it has in the past. Like everybody, I'm Zoom fatigued because a lot of my work is over Zoom. But it's also allowed me to remain engaged with the school nutrition directors and programs and organizations that are supporting, helping feed kids during this time.
Maggie Murphy at Piney Creek School in Allegheny County. Tell us about grades and achievement. Have you noticed any changes because of all of this?
Yeah, so I think that, you know, grading has been a big equity issue throughout this whole process. During the school closure back in the spring, a lot of districts were really torn on how to effectively grade student work because, as Julie mentioned, there were students without access. So, of course, it was unfair to expect the same of a student that didn't have a computer or didn't have Wi-Fi as a student who has everything they need at their fingertips at home. And so to grade those two kids on the same scale or even expect the same work, no matter their ability level to begin with, you know, it's not something that we were able to do. And so starting this year, thankfully, we're so grateful to, like, our local broadband provider was able to connect some families in the spring. But by this fall, we were able to have more plans in place, the hot spots and the things that we could make sure that we had that available to all families. So grading could maybe be a little bit more equitable. For my students here that are face-to-face, I think we are carrying on just like normal as best we can. I do worry, you know, of course, having an A week, B week, we're able to cover less curriculum. But what we do cover, like I said earlier, with having smaller classes, I can almost get through, you know, more curriculum in those days that they are with me. So I think all of that has to be considered. And then when we have our virtual students, you know, we're meeting more as a district. We're working more in our PLCs to make sure that all fourth graders across the county are working at a similar pace, if not the same pace, so that if we transition back into the classroom or if we transition to Plan C and have to all go virtual, that all fourth graders are learning, you know, at the same rate so that we can keep them where they need to be and prepare them as best we can for the next year.
It sounds like the plan is in place. How prepared do you think, Maggie, the teachers and students are should you actually go back to Plan C, really ready kind of psychologically, intellectually to go back?
Yes, I think that we have shifted so much and everything has been just on standby. At one point, we were talking about coming back Plan A and having all students back. The same week, we had some positive cases and we're told, you know, it could be Plan C. So I think as teachers, we know that we have to be flexible and we know what we have to do for our students. And we're going to make that happen no matter what. So if I get to see them in face to face, I'm going to teach them as best I can. If we go virtual, I'm going to teach my heart out that way too. So I think it's super important just that we have that outlook. Our district has provided some great professional development for us on blended learning, how to do that effectively. And we've had, you know, several meetings. Again, like our PLCs are working on, if this plan takes place, this is what we'll do. Have your schedules ready just in case. We have everything set up just in case anything were to happen, which is a luxury, you know, that we didn't have in the spring. So I think we learned from that and we're ready to do whatever is needed for our students, which just speaks to the heart of teachers, I think.
Julie, if Rutherford County schools remain under Plan B, you think your daughters will consider returning to in-person classes in the spring?
Absolutely. We had to commit for a semester for them to be virtual for the first semester. So they are definitely ready to go back. We had a long discussion about it this week and this morning, and they're ready to make that transition. And frankly, so am I. I think that, you know, as social human beings, we're meant to be around other people, and I think they're ready to be around more people than just our small little bubble. And their teachers are ready to have them back, too.
Julie Pittman, a public school parent and North Carolina Education Outreach Manager at No Kid Hungry North Carolina. She's going to remain with us. Maggie Murphy's a teacher at Piney Creek School in Allegheny County. Maggie, thank you so much for being on our program.
Thank you for having me.
We'll continue our conversation about the challenges faced by parents, students, and educators in North Carolina just ahead. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Meals are among the many benefits of in-person learning that students under Plan C have been missing this year. Under normal conditions, the state feeds close to 1 million public school students per year, but many of those students no longer have access to those meals. Julie Pittman is still with us. In addition to being a parent of a remote schooling student, in fact, students, She serves as the NC Education Outreach Coordinator for No Kid Hungry North Carolina. Julie, remote learners have faced food insecurity since March, and food insecurity, of course, is a problem generally, but it was made worse by this. Schools initially closed for COVID-19, and then when schools are open, how many North Carolina public school students are being served meals during the day?
Well, it's hard to say that on a day-by-day basis, but if we look at it by the week, normally we were in North Carolina public schools feeding about 1.2 million meals a week pre-COVID, and now it's less than half of that. We also want to look, too, at the fact that in North Carolina, around 1 in 6 students prior to COVID was facing some kind of food insecurity. Mm. And now, because of the economic distress that the pandemic has placed on all of our communities, it's now at least 1 in 4 children who are at risk of not getting the healthy food that they need.
Well, are schools doing anything about it? I know there are some school districts in some areas where the schools are offering those meals, that they're available. Is it access to those meals? Are they all offering the meals too? What accounts for the dip in distribution?
Well, I think it's a multifaceted answer there as well. So all the districts are feeding students in some capacity, and we're very thankful for the USDA who's extended the waiver so that all schools can feed any child from birth to 18 at no cost, whether that child is enrolled in school or not, across the state of North Carolina. But meals look different in each district because of either the district need or the capacity to be able to feed those students. Some schools are doing a curbside grab and go on a daily basis. Other districts like mine are doing curbside grab and go for remote students or those who are not in Plan B face to face on a weekly basis. Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools is offering a 5-day meal bundle. Other districts are doing that as well. So it looks different based on the needs and the capacity.
Now, what are schools doing? I know there are some innovative accommodations that school districts are making in order to get more of this food out there. Can you give us some samples and some examples?
Yes. So we are looking at school districts who are making sure that they are partnering with their local farms so that they can get farm-to-school meals, fresh fruit and vegetable grants, making sure that kids are getting the types of food that they're used to getting at school, but also just some really fresh food that's supporting their local farmers. They are packaging meals and marketing them in ways that are encouraging kids and families to come to the school and get meals. I know Cumberland County Schools did a big backyard picnic program where they packaged up food picnic style and then was able to partner with a local organization to get information about taking a picnic with your kid in the backyard and identifying all kinds of things in your backyard as sort of an additional learning piece. They're dressing up at the curbside to try to encourage people to come. They're making sure that they're delivering meals to the classrooms or having kids be able to walk through the cafeteria and pick up their meals and take them back to the classrooms if they're face-to-face. I mean, these school nutrition professionals are working tirelessly to make sure not only that they are feeding as many kids as they can, but that they're still able to engage with students because they care about kids.
Well, so tell us where families can get more information on how to get meals if they still need them.
Sure. You can make a point to have your kids get the school meals and encouraging other families to do so by calling your local school, by talking to your county office or your principal at your local school, whether you're enrolled in that school or not, and find out what the meal service looks like. I know that we have lots of school districts that are also partnering with their local charter schools and other agencies that feed meals like YMCAs and after-school programs. So call the school, find out what they're doing, when meals are available, plug into their social media sites, You can also look on our No Kid Hungry North Carolina website and be able to find an interactive map. You can also just look, call your local school and school nutrition director to find out where your meals will be in.
All right, Julie Pittman, the NC Education Outreach Coordinator for No Kid Hungry North Carolina. Julie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, the challenges that COVID-19 presents for learning aren't limited to students and parents. Obstacles extend to teachers as well, including those who requested to teach remotely and had their request denied. Liz Schlemmer is WUNC's education reporter. She's been talking with some of those teachers about what the future may hold. Welcome back, Liz.
Hi, Frank. Glad to be here.
Do we know how many North Carolina teachers wanted to teach remotely but were denied their request?
Well, we know there were at least hundreds who were denied, likely more than 1,000. The North Carolina Association of Educators received requests for legal help from people in a handful of counties. I checked on those, and I'm aware of at least 7 counties where there were pockets of school employees who were denied the request, and there could be more.
Well, let's talk about the teachers and the staff, those who requested to teach remotely only. What were some of the reasons they gave?
Some applied for their own health concerns, some out of concern for a family member, especially someone who lives with them. One common case is taking care of an elderly parent, and one teacher told me that the stories that she's heard from others who were denied range from having premature infant twins to, you know, an 80-year-old parent that lives with them. And of course, some of these health concerns like diabetes and obesity are quite common and sometimes come along together.
All right, well, let's take a look at the other side of this, the decision-making process. The state leaves that, the decision about which teachers get granted their request, to individual districts. So what are the factors that the districts are considering when they make the decision?
This is really hard on districts, too. You know, the Department of Public Instruction provided guidance to school districts to have a transparent process to consider these requests to teach remotely, but the logistics of keeping schools fully staffed are really messy. There are a lot of things that school districts have to meet, like class size mandates in the lower grades. Teachers have to be certified to teach their specific subject, especially in middle and high school. And that makes it harder to shuffle teachers around and assign one person a virtual class and, you know, and potentially move the teachers. Also, there's still a major substitute teacher shortage in many counties in the state. That's been an ongoing issue, and the pandemic is only exacerbating that.
I know that you requested data from Wake County schools about their requests from teachers. What did you find out?
So for context here, Wake County Schools employs about 20,000 people, and out of that, they've granted 1,500 requests for school-based employees who wanted to work remotely. So they granted 1,500, and they denied about 300 other requests, most often teachers who were concerned about a family member who lived with them. And at the time I requested the data a couple weeks ago, they also had another 500 applications pending. And this is because it was still shortly after the school district had announced that they would be going in person, and, you know, a bunch more people put in their applications.
I know that you talked to several of the teachers, some of whom have resigned. Tell us about Vanessa Barnett Loro. Her story, I think, illuminates a lot of what you're reporting on.
Vanessa said goodbye to her class of elementary students, her fifth graders, a couple weeks ago during the last week that Wake County Public Schools was all virtual. And she resigned from Wake County Public Schools out of fear for the safety of her 70-year-old mother. Her mom has some complicated health issues that put her at high risk. It's safe to say that she's in poor health. And their family has been very careful throughout the pandemic. You know, I heard this from many of the teachers who had applied to teach remotely, that they were only going grocery shopping once every 2 weeks or, you know, a couple times a month, and being very careful, not leaving their homes, not hugging family members. And in general, Vanessa said she didn't feel it was safe for anyone to go back, but she was really specifically concerned about her mom. So she resigned. Her students were split up in several other classes, so the other classes really just got larger and absorbed her students.
Well, I know you've spoken with teachers all over North Carolina, including a teacher named Shelley. She's a high-risk individual. Tell us more about what she's been going through.
Shelley is the one that really sticks out in my mind. So the CDC lists 9 conditions that put someone at a high risk for a severe case of COVID-19. Of those 9, she has 3 of them, including heart failure. So her heart doesn't pump enough blood. She gets easily winded. She has a pacemaker. In addition to 2 other conditions, she thought for sure that she would be granted the option to teach remotely. She had a doctor's note that she submitted. She thought she was, you know, a shoo-in for this because she is so high risk. But her county school district denied her the option to teach remotely along with some other high-risk individuals in her county. So as a solution, she worked out with her principal. She's teaching sort of remotely, but in the building, in the same room as her students. She's in a tech booth in an auditorium. So if you can imagine a high school auditorium and in the back behind the seats is a booth where someone would run lights for the high school play, she's teaching from in there remotely to students who were then down in the risers watching her on a projector.
It's probably too early to tell. There are so many districts, so many requests to try to gather all this data. But as you say, each district gets to make its own choice. Is there any way to tell about disparities? Who's making what kind of decisions based on what kind of parameters? I mean, is there any way to know yet? And how transparent is the system for us to know whether or not these decisions are being handed out equally?
Well, I talked to Tom Tomberlin, who works for HR at the Department of Public Instruction. You know, DPI put out guidance for each of these school districts, but he said ultimately teachers are employees to their district, and you know, each school district gets to make the final decision on these things. But they are encouraged to give other accommodations if they deny someone. So, you know, the best way that I found out was I asked the North Carolina Association of Educators where they'd heard of cases, and then I started calling teachers in those counties and checking it out and talking to people. So it is hard to say exactly how widespread this is. I think in general, resignations and retirements this year are a concern. People who, you know, have moved to early retirement or resigned when they would not have otherwise, there's concern about whether that's going to have a lasting impact. But the Department of Public Instruction doesn't have data statewide on those retirements and resignations and won't have that publicly until next fall.
What about those teachers who've been denied? Can they appeal that decision?
In some counties, yes. Their districts create an appeal process. And in some of those cases, you know, a large number of teachers appealed and some of them were given other accommodations.
All right. Well, I'm going to get a couple more case studies, or maybe we can also talk about adaptations. You talked about in Shelley's case, you know, being in the tech booth of the auditorium and teaching kind of remotely within the school. What are some of the other adaptations that schools have made?
Well, one, she's wearing a lot of PPE. You know, so she's got a mask and she's got a face shield and she's in this booth in the back. I was told by some superintendents that they might offer other accommodations, like relieving a teacher from hallway duty and lunch monitoring, trying to get them a separate entrance, and just to reduce duties that put them in the face of a lot of students at once. Shelley told me that she still doesn't feel safe, you know, even if the risk of transmission is lower, just her risk of what might happen if she got COVID is so high that it makes her feel unsafe.
You know, you point out the districts are in a rough place because they've got to somehow figure out how to keep staffing levels at the right place, and it's not an easy chore. On the other hand, if teachers resign, then that leaves them pretty much in the same boat. Kelly Poulos is a 54-year-old high school English teacher in Cabarrus County who is retiring mid-semester because her school district is transitioning to in-person classes. Tell us more about her decision.
She told me this was a really hard decision for her to retire early. She wasn't ready to retire. She wants to still be teaching. And for her, retiring early came at a cost. So teachers in North Carolina can retire with full benefits after 30 years of service. She was about 2 school years short of that. And because of that, she's going to lose about $400 a month from her pension for the rest of her life. And, you know, you add that up year after year, and it could cost her more than $100,000. But she was really concerned for the health of her husband, as well as her mother, who lives with her, who's in her 80s. And she was trying to figure out, you know, how she could work it out, whether she was even considering moving out of her house, as we've heard some healthcare workers doing, to protect her family. Ultimately, she decided to retire early.
So where does this leave the school when you balance all of this, maybe the early retirements, in terms of staffing? Where does this leave these districts?
I've heard so many questions and concerns about whether the resignations and the retirements could stack up enough to hurt schools long term. You know, some of the resignations, maybe those teachers will come back or they'll teach at another school district soon, but it's not as easy to come out of retirement. You know, and there's going to be shuffling, and there's going to be a need for subs and long-term substitute teachers. But I think the big question right now that many people are wondering, we don't have the data for yet, is just, you know, how widespread is this going to be? Are there going to be resignations from burnout as well as health concerns? And how long is that impact going to be felt?
Liz Schlemmer, WNC Education Reporter. Thank you, Liz.
Yeah, thanks, Frank.
You can find links to her reporting at our website, stateofthings.org. The State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Amanda Magnus, Grant Hollow-Mormon, Kaya Findlay, and Stacia Brown. Elikam Dodor is our intern. Jenny Lawson, our technical director. Al Wadarski also helped engineer today's show. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacia.